listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Robert Reich has been ranked by Time magazine as one of the top 10 most successful cabinet members in history for his achievement in the Clinton administration. They included implementing the Family and Medical Leave Act, raising the minimum wage, and leading a crackdown on sweatshops. He's the author of numerous books. The most recent was called Supercapitalism. And Secretary Reich is teaching at UC Berkeley these days. You can read his blog at robertreich.blogspot.com. I'm very pleased to welcome the 22nd Secretary of Labor back to our show. Hello. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, Leonard, it's always a pleasure to talk to you as well. How are you?
I'm fine. The last time we spoke was in September 2007 when you came by to discuss supercapitalism. I'd like to start us off with a clip from that interview. Let's take a listen.
I mean, I see this, the road to supercapitalism, as a road that we, as a society, without really spending much time thinking about it, as consumers and investors became more powerful, and as citizens we became less and less powerful, we just did it. And now we find ourselves at the start of the 21st century as consumers and investors actually pretty well off. As citizens, we are quite almost silenced.
A lot has changed since 2007. Are we still stuck on the road to supercapitalism?
Well, supercapitalism is still the dominant form of capitalism, Leonard. It's been shaken up very, very badly. We don't know what's coming next. As consumers and investors, we discovered that the market could not do it on its own, and that the citizen in us, the citizen that might have wanted, for example, regulations of financial markets and regulations protecting small investors and protecting people who were trying to get their mortgage, a new mortgage, and so forth. As citizens, we did come out very poorly, and ironically, because the citizen in us could not be given any voice and did not have much voice, it turned out that we as consumers and investors paid the price.
Well, were we even paying much attention when a few people warned us that things were going seriously wrong? They were accused of being pessimists and partisans. Do we need to suffer a major economic meltdown to make the public pay attention?
Well, unfortunately, business as usual means that Wall Street and major corporate lobbyists in Washington are going to be in charge of what happens without the kind of explosion that occurs periodically. Citizens are fairly dormant. We just simply allow the system to do as it will. And it's not even clear, Leonard, that after this explosion, this terrible financial explosion that took down the rest of us, it's not even clear that we will see at the end of the day regulations that prevent this from happening again. Wall Street has very, very powerful players in Washington. It's not just the fact that they have lobbyists, but also Wall Street and the executives on Wall Street have been contributing a lot of money to Democratic as well as Republican campaigns. So I don't want to be pessimistic. The economy right now gives enough room to be pessimistic simply by looking and seeing and experiencing what everybody else is seeing and experiencing. But the real challenge for us is to get some control back over the economy.
In a way, can this situation be seen as an opportunity to address issues that haven't gotten much mainstream attention in the past few decades, like widening income inequality? Because the income gap has grown an awful lot over the past 30 years, hasn't it?
It certainly has, Leonard. I mean, just as an example, if you go back to 1980, as recently as 1980, the top 1% by income and wealth were taking home about 9% of national income, total national income that year. But since then, income and wealth have both become far more concentrated. So by 2007, the top 1% was taking home more than 21% of total national income. And you see, there's a huge problem in terms of simply maintaining the economy, because there's not enough demand for goods and services if the middle class doesn't have enough money. They can keep up their spending only by going into debt, and that's exactly what we experienced between 2001 and 2007. Median wages, median incomes actually declined, people kept on spending because they assumed that their houses were piggy banks and they could refinance and get home equity loans and go deeper and deeper into debt. And as long as housing prices continued to rise, that was okay. Well, it wasn't okay. And the big question that greets us now, aside from how do we regulate financial markets to prevent this from happening again, is how do we reconstitute enough consumer demand if the middle class continues to get such a relatively small proportion of total national income.
President Obama has proposed increasing top bracket taxes from 33% to 36% and 35% to 39.6%. Is that addressing income inequality adequately?
Well, it certainly is a step in the right direction, but you would think from all of the yelling and screaming from Republicans and from conservative Democrats and from wealthy individuals that this was confiscation, that this was a terrible thing. Well, the rates that President Obama is proposing are basically what we had in the 1990s under Bill Clinton. The economy did not suffer in those years. In fact, as I recall, I was a member of the cabinet for many of those years. As I recall, the economy did remarkably well.
Although we did have a couple of bubbles that drove it along.
We had a bubble at the end. We certainly did have an internet bubble, a tech bubble. But overall, if you look at those years in the 1990s, they were the only years we've had since the early 1970s in which the income gap between the wealthy and the poor actually started to narrow. Because employers needed people, and employers wanted to pay people even at the bottom of the income ladder more in order to attract them. Well, I think it was a fairly successful economy, notwithstanding the tax rates, marginal tax rates, were higher than they are now.
I'm talking with Robert Reich, who is currently teaching at UC Berkeley, also blogging at robertreich.blogspot.com. And a little over a month ago, on Friday, April 3rd, you wrote on your blog that the current economic crisis is still not the Great Depression of the 1930s, but it is a depression. Now, I'm always confused about the word depression because I remember that the word recession was coined to minimize the psychological impact of using a word like depression. Is this, if we are in fact in a depression, do you think it could wind up matching the Great Depression in scope?
Oh, I doubt it very much, Leonard, because we know a great deal more than we knew in the 1930s about how these downturns in the economy can be contained. We now understand monetary policy. We now understand that the Federal Reserve Board can not only reduce interest rates, but can do what Ben Bernanke has been doing, and that is essentially expanding the money supply far beyond what anybody assumed the Fed could do. We also know a lot about fiscal policy. We know that the federal government can stimulate the economy, and the stimulus can help. We know a great deal about consumer behavior that we didn't know in the 1930s. Although this is an extremely bad recession, I have called it a depression because unemployment is just about at double digits. In fact, if you consider everybody who's too discouraged even to look for work who's unemployed, we are at 10% nationally unemployment.
The underemployment rate just hit 15.8% last month.
Yes, and underemployment, for anybody who's who's listening and doesn't understand the definition, underemployment means everybody includes not only people who are unemployed and people who are too discouraged to look for work, but also people who are working part-time who'd rather be working full-time. And you're right, Leonard, that's up to 15%. But we're not yet near 1930s depression levels, where one out of four people who wanted to work were out of work.
But listening to your reassurances, we heard those same kinds of reassurances, which suggested that we couldn't get into this kind of economic crisis in the first place. We learned so much about the depression from the depression. We've learned so much from other economic downturns, and here we are with a really serious crisis.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly not defending conventional macroeconomics. I never had and never will. I think that a lot of people, both in the economics profession and a lot of people who were relying on fancy economics models, were shocked and surprised, and they should not have been, in the sense that there were a lot of warning signs out there. I mean, for example, let's go back to our discussion about wages and earnings. If the median wage, that means half of people are earning more, half of people are earning less, if that median wage is declining, adjusted for inflation, as it did between 2001 and 2007, but housing prices during those same years are doubling, well, something has got to give. I mean, housing traditionally has used up about a third of the typical family's income. Well, just mathematically and logically, something is going to give. That you can't sustain that kind of increase in housing prices and expect people to continue to pay. Also, once shares of stock, where you know traditionally they are maybe share prices are 6 or 7 times earnings, but when they get up to 12 or 14 or 15 times earnings, again, you've got to scratch your head and say, well, something has got to give. I mean, I think a lot of people did know that it was a gigantic bubble, but people on the inside were making too much money. They didn't want to blow the whistle. They figured that there might be a couple of years left to make even more money, and a lot of regulators went to sleep.
And a lot of predictions were made on CNBC. The White House has said it thinks the unemployment rate will continue to rise until 2010, even if we begin to see signs of economic growth. Why would the rate continue to increase if the economy is growing?
Well, for a couple of reasons. First, unemployment is what economists call a lagging indicator. Employers generally wait until they're sure that there are consumers out there and it is a recovery and a robust recovery before employers will go to the time and trouble and expense of hiring somebody back or hiring somebody new. So generally speaking, what you see after recessions or deep recessions or depressions is unemployment going up for a few years. And even when you have a clear recovery, you have a few years of what we call jobless recoveries. I remember I was Secretary of Labor in the early 1990s when everybody was saying, at least everybody, every economist was saying, the economy is recovering, and yet jobs were not coming back. People were very frustrated, understandably. This time around, I think it'll be even jobs will be even slower to come back, for the reason that I emphasized a moment ago, and that is that there's a big question mark hanging over the recovery when it does happen, and that is where the demand will come from. Consumers now constitute 70% of our gross domestic product, but consumers, remember, can't keep up their rate of consumption that they were undertaking between in the early part of this decade, because they maintained it only by going deep into debt, and that is not sustainable.
My guest is Robert Reich, now at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also blogging at robertreich.blogspot.com, and you may remember when he visited us a couple of years ago to talk about his latest book, Supercapitalism. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Robert Reich, who served as Secretary of Labor during the Clinton administration. We're talking about the current state of the economy. And Professor Reich, on Wednesday, the White House proposed a detailed effort to overhaul regulations on financial instruments like derivatives. Well, the last time that you were here, we talked about the United States' ability to shape financial regulation, and maybe we should listen to what you said and then get into what's happening now.
The United States is the most powerful economy in the world. Every company in the world has to sell and do business in the United States if it is really going to make money. Therefore, we have huge leverage over every global company because we can always say to them, if you're not going to play by our rules, you don't get to come here.
And yet here we are today talking about how we never really did much with that ability to regulate.
No, Leonard, we don't. And not only, obviously, should we with regard to financial markets, but the real question is going to be to what extent we can overcome the political lobbying, campaign contribution, et cetera, power of Wall Street and a lot of other interests that just don't want the kind of regulations that are necessary. I do believe that we have the leverage over the global financial economy. If we regulate in a certain way, others are going to follow our example because investors want the safety of a regulatory regime that is going to protect them.
Well, we're talking now suddenly about tighter regulations all around. Was there a sense that regulations were okay when you were on our show a couple of years ago?
At that time, Leonard, I and many others were looking at financial markets and saying, number one, the Glass-Steagall Act that really used to separate commercial from investing investment banks ought to be resurrected. Things are getting out of control. Number two, the credit rating agencies have a huge conflict of interest because they're rating the issues from the companies that pay them. Number three, Wall Street salaries are getting out of control, and they are dependent on making more and more extraordinary bets rather than living with the results of those bets. So there is a bias toward risk. Now, that was known several years ago. It was not just, I was one of thousands of people who were looking at financial markets and saying this. But the problem was, again, people on the inside were making too much money, and regulators had no incentive on the outside to do much of anything. In fact, as you might recall, Hank Paulson became Secretary of the Treasury at a time when he and almost everybody else was saying the danger is that American financial markets will become uncompetitive because we are overregulated. He came to Washington determined to reduce financial regulation. Now the stars, I think, are lined up appropriately to do something about the problems I just mentioned and other problems. But the question is, again, whether there's enough political will to do it.
Both Robert Rubin and Alan Greenspan, who were superstars during the Clinton administration, have come under fire for their opposition to regulating derivatives in the 1990s. I'd like to read one of President Obama's answers from the New York Times Sunday Magazine interview he gave David Lenhart recently. The president said, "When I first started having a roundtable of economic advisors, and Bob Reich was part of that, and he was sitting across the table from Bob Rubin and others, what you discovered was that some of the rifts that had existed back in the Clinton years had really narrowed drastically." Did he get it right? Have the ideological differences between you and Robert Rubin really narrowed drastically?
Well, I think that the differences between us were kind of exaggerated at the time. In the early 1990s, Bob Rubin was more concerned, I think it's fair to say, about deficits than I was. I thought it was more important for the president, President Clinton, to follow through on his agenda on health, education, and infrastructure, building up the middle class, creating more opportunities for the lower middle class and the poor. I can't speak for Bob Rubin. I think that I I didn't change my views. I mean, we were always very cordial and very civil, and there was never any animosity. But there was a kind of a difference in view also about markets. I complained again and again about what I called corporate welfare, the extent to which the government was essentially subsidizing companies for no reason other than that they had powerful lobbies in Washington. I think, again, it's fair to say that Bob didn't like the term, didn't feel that we should be castigating Wall Street or corporate America in any way, that it was unfair to CEOs and to Wall Street executives to suggest that they were motivated in any way that was inappropriate or improper. So these are differences of worldview, and I respect and continue to respect Bob Rubin's views. I think time has sort of revealed that he and Alan Greenspan and at the time Larry Summers were wrong about regulation, wrong about their rejection of regulation, whether it was the credit default swaps that they decided not to regulate, or their desire to take down the Glass-Steagall Act, the wall separating commercial and investment banking. That proved to be ill-advised as well. Now, in fairness, could they have seen in the late 1990s all that might result in the late part of this decade? Well, I think that's a lot to ask.
And then you came up again in that conversation, although you don't have to respond to this if you don't want to. A few sentences down in their exchange, David Linhart interrupted the president to say, "Larry Summers is the new Bob Reich." Is Larry Summers making arguments you would be making if you were a member of the Obama administration?
I don't really know, and again, I'm going to take your invitation and not comment.
My guest is not Larry Summers. He's Robert Reich, a former Secretary of Labor during the Clinton administration, currently teaching at the University of California, Berkeley, and also has a blog, which is robertreich.blogspot.com. This is WNYC, wnyc.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Christina Romer, the chair of the White House Council on Economic Advisors, said the recovery will be driven by business investment in things like renewable energy, not consumer spending. Do you think that we're experiencing a long-term economic shift in the United States right now?
I do think we are, but it's hard to understand why businesses would, in and of themselves, of their own volition, make new, very expensive investments in, say, alternative non-carbon-based energy, unless they were motivated to, or unless they had to, unless there were regulations forcing them to.
Or government subsidized, as they are in Germany.
Yes, or government subsidies that would provide them a motivation. But absent a carrot or a stick, I don't see them doing it automatically. We need either a cap and trade system. We need subsidies to for new business investment, and or we need a fuel tax, a carbon tax.
Well, if consumer spending isn't going to drive the economy, then what do we need? New metrics to gauge growth in this new economy?
Well, there are really two separate questions there, Leonard. One is, if it's not consumer spending, what's going to drive the new economy? It's not going to be corporations doing it of their own, if they're not consumers out there, to buy goods and services. It's not going to be exports, although the middle classes of India and China are growing, and I would expect the dollar to decline as we come out of this deep recession, depression. So export markets will grow, but that's not going to be enough. I would expect, therefore, that government, through subsidizing alternative energies, through providing more public provision of safety nets and so forth, is going to have to take up some of the slack. Now, the other question embedded in the question that you just asked me was, do we need new metrics with regard to thinking about economic growth? And the answer there is yes. Right now, we are sort of married to the idea that the best thing that can happen, the only thing that can happen, the only way we measure economic success is through increases in the gross domestic product. And yet we know that the GDP grows for all sorts of reasons. It may grow because we are buying more crime prevention equipment. It may grow because we are working so hard that we have to buy more drugs to reduce our stress levels. In other words, mere economic growth driven by consumption spending doesn't mean we're any better off.
How would you assess the state of organized labor today? The United Auto Workers Union now owns a huge portion of General Motors. What do you think that means to the future of the U.S. auto industry and unions in general?
Well, I think that another lesson we may have learned, hopefully from this deep downturn, is that consumers need more buying power. And if they need more buying power, that means workers also need more bargaining power to get higher wages. I think that unions are very important. I may be old-fashioned, but I think that we need to enlarge the number of workers in unions and give middle-class, lower-middle-class, working-poor Americans more bargaining leverage to get higher wages. The Employee Free Choice Act has flaws, but I think it is very important. It's stalled in Congress right now, but we need to enable people who want to create and form and join unions. We need to enable them to do so. You asked me what's the future of the UAW with regard to owning Chrysler.
They just reduced their $20 billion the General Motors, their pledge to the United Auto Workers to cover health care obligations.
Yeah. I mean, the auto industry in the United States is not a growing industry. It's a shrinking industry. Auto workers' salaries, adjusted for inflation, have been declining for years. The number of auto workers in the United States, even including the transplants from Japan and Korea, and Germany, have been decreasing for years. The places where unionization is increasing is in the local service economy, retail, restaurants, hotel, hospital workers, and these workers are among the lowest paid in America. They need bargaining leverage more than anybody, and they are beginning to unionize. That's a good thing.
You wrote on your blog this past Monday that only with a government plan that competes with private insurers and offers Americans lower costs if the providers and insurers fail to reform themselves, will the system be genuinely reformed? We have very little time, but will you address health care? Do you think it's likely we're going to get a really effective health care package passed in this Congress?
Well, I think we're going to get a health care package passed this year. The big question is whether inside that health care package is a public insurance alternative that Americans can choose if they want to. Don't have to choose it. They can stick with a private insurance carrier. But there's got to be, in order to provide the right incentives for private insurance carriers to do what they need to do, to expand coverage and reduce costs, there's got to be a public alternative. And that's going to be the big fight. Congress is not going to be fighting over whether you have universal health care. I think everybody is more or less agreed that that's coming. The big fight is the public insurance alternative inside that health care plan.
And I keep on getting emails from conservative groups that suggest that we are headed straight into socialist hell.
A lot of conservative groups have been saying that since Franklin D. Roosevelt became president. And there are people who say that, you know, we've been on the road since then towards socialist hell. I don't think so. The United States, compared to any other advanced country, is the outlier in terms of small government, no national health insurance, very little public provision of safety nets. you know, if you call the what we are or what we're trending towards socialism, then your definition of socialism is pretty broad.
The Obama administration has also pursued offshore tax havens, and you've written that has strategic implications for health care reform. In less than a minute, can you explain?
Oh, yes. Well, one of the big questions hanging over health care, in addition to will there be a public insurance alternative, is where is the money going to come from to pay for all of this? And right now, the administration is frantically looking for revenue sources. I mean, it first of all wanted to limit the deductions that very wealthy people could take against their income taxes, and the congressional leaderships, a lot of Democrats, said no. And then it wanted to go after offshore tax havens, and of course, corporate America is saying no, you can't do that. Another idea bouncing around Congress is going after employer-provided health care for wealthy people, which is tax-free. It's tax-free for everybody, but why should the wealthy get tax-free employer-provided health care? Again, there's a lot of pushback. But unless the Obama administration finds a revenue source that's going to come up with something in the order of $600, $700 billion over the next 10 years to help pay for health care, then it's going to be very difficult to get much of a subsidy for the middle class, lower middle class, and the poor.
You can read Robert Reich's thoughts on his blog, robertreich.blogspot.com, and we have a link to that blog on our website. Secretary Reich is teaching at University of California, Berkeley these days. The last book was Super Capitalism. A new one in the works?
Yes. In fact, Leonard, touching on some of the issues you and I have talked about today.
Well, we have run out of time, and when the book comes out, we'll talk about it.
Great.